back with an all-new episode of Keep It Padam Padam.
Week two of Kylie Mania.
That's my name. I changed it legally.
I am somewhat surprised that every queer on Twitter is making Padam Padam jokes. It's rare that we get a really centralized Kylie Minogue conversation, even among the gays. But anyway, I'm Louis Fertel. I'm a big Kylie Minogue fan.
I think that I was shocked how much it really sort of like took hold of people. And I know that there, you know, there's been some a grassroots insurgency amongst the Minogers.
Sure.
You know, they you know, sometimes you get a moment. Disco was really a moment because we were all trapped in the house and wishing we were at a disco.
Right.
But, you know, like, there'll be a big moment and the Kylie gays are sort of like, they're talking about it, but no one's listening. But this week, everybody is talking about this fucking song. People are making memes about it. And honestly, it's great. It sort of ties into what we're talking about this week, right? We're going to discuss the Donna Summer documentary that aired on HBO, amongst other things. But there's a moment in the beginning where they're talking about how Love to Love You Baby wasn't a hit and it kept ending too soon. And people kept saying, put that back on. And they realized they had to make like a 17, 20 minute version. And then it was a fucking hit and it sold a million copies, right? And I feel like this is that song because it's on, there's no fucking chorus. It's one of those like 2 minute songs. As soon as it ends, you have to play it again because you still want to hear the fucking song. And then at the end of it, I'm just sort of like, once I stop playing it on loop for a while, I'm just sort of like, well, that's not really a song.
I feel the same way. I wish it were a more epic thing. And there's plenty of obviously great Kylie remixes, so I'm sure we'll get the proper 11-minute version of this. But it's just the disease of Old Town Road. Now we have these songs come out that are, you know, a minute 58, like we're Jerry Lee Lewis or Chuck Berry. It's like some 50s shit. And for that reason, I mean, I guess I could just play it five times in a row, but the song is actually diminishing for me as even as a fan. Like, I'm excited for the rest of the album, but I have to tell you, do you know what I think Kylie Minogue should do? I didn't expect to go down this track early in the episode, but I'm happy we're here. I would like to hear a Kylie cover. And my suggestion is Where My Girl's At by 702, which I just heard yesterday. Picture her singing that. Like, I love, again, we talked about her Body Language album, which has R&B elements to it. When she kind of sinks into a groove like that, to me, that's when Kylie reels me in the most. And I think she would do a song like that really well.
Well, listen, I mean, Kylie is always at her best when she is discussing the politics of the dance floor. You know, so wondering where her girls are.
Would be perfect for her.
I feel like her top five songs are literally her telling a man, you're not dancing enough, or get out of my way because I need to dance, or just her talking about, you know what I'm doing? I'm spinning around.
It really is all dance-centric and dancing at or near a man, and I would like to hear maybe one dimension of I brought my posse with me because I don't think we've heard that from her.
She's just horny.
I guess.
Not as horny as Jessie Ware, because she's literally mostly like, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? Like, if you don't want to dance, get out of my way, because I'm going to dance. She's very much Julianne Moore and Gloria Bell, just on the dance floor, twirling by herself, listening to the music.
Right. Which is, you know, it gives demented Blue Jasmine talking to herself in the park vibes. You know what I mean? Like, who really needs to dance by themselves that much?
I mean, listen, I'm sure you run into Kylie Minogue on the dance floor and she's like whispering about Studio 54 and what she remembers from there, and you're like, ma'am, I just asked what you wanted to drink.
Lost in the music.
Now, did you wait in line last night for 4 hours to meet Kylie Minogue at Kylie Wines?
No, I was being a responsible striking writer, so I was on the picket line. I was at the Disney lot, if you're looking for like an idyllic walk as a striker, I really recommend it because there's lots of places to walk. You can put your earphones in. You don't have to talk with like 25 writers about whatever projects you are or aren't working on. That's just for my colleagues out there. But I am a little jealous, though. My thing is I don't drink, so like Kylie sparkling wine doesn't speak to me. And I also have actually met Kylie Minogue before. 10 years ago at the New Now Next Awards, I was on the red carpet. I know you're bedazzled by the glamour I'm bringing right now. But I was co-hosting an event with Willem of Drag Race fame. In my opinion, still the funniest person ever to be on Drag Race. Chaotic though Willem is.
I mean, yeah. Gave us our best Drag Race adjacent meme, right? With yes. Derek Berry. No one died at Stonewall.
No. someone who actually knows stuff. I just love Willem. But at the New Now Next Awards, we both were talking to each other, and it was a live stream, and I asked him, I was like, is there any celebrity who, if they come by, you just want to talk to solo, like you're so obsessed with them? And I think he said he wanted to talk to Fergie or something. And I said, okay, well, I'm a huge Kylie Minogue stan, so if Kylie Minogue comes by, and I know she won't, she's performing, whatever, I'd like to talk to her. Lo and behold, Kylie Minogue does come by. Willem stays right in frame. He's running the whole show too. I'm like trying to ask like provocative questions about like the locomotion and the Abbey Road sessions. And did she ever meet Little Eva? She never met Little Eva. But we all got a picture together and it was very cute. So I still have that.
I love that. I love that. I want to say something about the picket lines.
Okay. All right, Norma Ray. Here we go.
You call me Norma Nay. Because I don't think I'm ever setting foot on a WGA East picket line again. Do you know they took a photo of me that is one of the worst photos of me that has ever been taken and put it on their Instagram? I feel disgusted.
Oh, no.
I feel like also the walking path in New York. New York is not an ideal place to be striking, baby.
I was okay. I struck at the upfronts in New York, and yeah, it was a skinny sidewalk and
yeah.
Nary a bathroom in sight.
I came there after you. I met our friend Matt Whitaker. I was doing the walking. There's no bath. It's also like you're just right here. It feels like you're walking around a hot dog stand. and then because it's New York, you know, the crazies come out. There's this man with this like DJ thing, you know, like with his Venmo up there so you can tip him. And I'm like, sir, I would tip you if you were playing anything besides Who Let the Dogs Out as She Works Hard for the Money. What the fuck am I supposed to do with that?
Okay, you know, She Works Hard for the Money, somewhat clever. That said, yes. Who Let the Dogs Out? Not a provocative question for the strikers.
Also, the New York strikers just aren't hot. People in New York are hotter on average, I feel like, than L.A., mm-hmm. But the writers in L.A. are a little bit hotter than the New York writers.
That might be true. That said, I mean, like, you know.
There are a lot of ugly writers, yeah. But the hot writers.
If they're going to go anywhere, they're going to L.A.
If they're
going
to go anywhere, they're going to go to L.A. Because they're also, you know, they're slashies, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're model slash, actor slash, stand-up slash writer. You know, they're in front of the camera.
Right. You have to spend more time outside in L.A., so you have to be a little bit cuter, you know, for everybody to see at all times. That said, I do want to talk about being in New York quickly. I saw Jessica Chastain in A Doll's House, which I did not know I was going to get the performance we got, which is, without spoiling, because you haven't seen it, correct?
No, I got booked for a Pride beauty campaign the day that I was supposed to go.
Oh, that happens at the end of A Doll's House, actually. Nora has to, she has to go. And it's
that's why she walks out of Torvald. Yeah, that's why she walks out of Torvald. Yeah.
She's like, it's the HRC calling. It's a very minimalist and I would describe it as grayscale production. And I've never really seen a play where they really kind of make you lean in and it's all about listening to the very specific and unadorned Ibsen dialogue. It really is shocking that it was written over 100 years ago. When you watch it, but Jessica Chastain does not overplay a single moment. And for a minute, when someone's giving you that kind of acting, you're thinking, is this enough? Is enough going on? And then by the end of it, you realize like you're clenched the entire time, really brought in by the restraint of what she's doing. And everybody else in Ariane Moriad, Tony nominee, is also fabulous in it. So
you mean my king from Succession?
That's the one. Yes. I mean, nominee from Succession. Yes.
And let me tell you something about Ibsen. I love Ibsen.
I think that's my favorite play that's over 100 years old.
I really like his play Ghosts. And one day I will revisit the adaptation of Ghosts that I wrote in undergrad.
I won't be revisiting that. So, okay, interesting. That's something we don't have in common.
Let's just say I changed syphilis to AIDS.
Oh my God. Call up the NEA. We have a grant like, ready to go.
I remember my professor, Sarah Gable. She was like, Ira, there's a lot going on in this.
She's like, would you maybe consider being a bookseller instead?
What else did you see?
Oh, and I also saw Sean Hayes in Goodnight Oscar. I think I was talking about this last week, where he plays Oscar Levant, who is a very famous pianist, composer, and also known hilarious wit, a very specific type of mid-century American celebrity. And Sean Hayes, to his credit, does not remind me once of Sean Hayes the entire time. And I kind of think of him as somebody we're thrilled to see him play Sean Hayes, generally speaking. You know, you see Jack and Will and Grace, and you are familiar with Sean Hayes, the entity, and they seem similar. Here, he really has he reminds me a little bit more of Milton Berle than Oscar Levant, but that's still the same era. And you just want to see a play about the backstage goings-on at a talk show where everybody's smoking constantly, and we're live on the air in a second, and everything can go wrong. So it's just, if you're obsessed with the 1950s television and the kind of pop culture emerging then, as I am, if you're obsessed with like shows like What's My Line, as I constantly bring up, really go and see it. It's fabulous to see. His performance is better than I think the play. Doug Wright wrote it, who did I Am My Own Wife, which I fucking love. One of the great 21st century plays. I think he won the Pulitzer for that too. I just go and see it. He's such a treasure in this role. And there's a sequence where people shoot to their feet and clap. And I don't know that you ever get that in a straight play otherwise.
Let me tell you, once the play about the backstage goings on of Keep It drops next season.
Oh, wow. Which Chilton employee will write that one? Me.
I will also say that it is a lot. I feel like you get a lot more plays in when you're visiting New York, I found, at least for me, than actually living here.
That makes sense. Yeah, there's an urgency.
It's like I have plans to see something with a friend. You know, I was going to see Once Upon a One More Time last week, right? And then a friend's like, oh, well, I have to go to this dinner. And so we, you know, reschedule it to another week. But, you know, it's like something like that. It's like, if you're here visiting, though, it's like, well, I got to see all these shows in like 3 days. So.
And it's such a pleasure to organize a trip that way. Just say, okay, I'm here like to serve the plays as an audience member. That's my primary function. I don't really care if I do anything else, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, our show this week.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That was a lot.
Donna Summer. The documentary hit HBO, and we're going to find out if we love to love it, baby, or if we want to dim all the lights.
Right, and say goodnight, right.
Yeah. And also, this episode, we have an amazing guest who I literally cannot believe has never been on Keep It before, because she's sort of like an ultimate Keep It guest. We have a great interview with Aisha Tyler.
Thank God she's here. I don't know what we were doing not having her on the show before, but she is as fabulous as you expect.
And then also, the girls are making sequels. There's Indiana Jones is coming out. There's The Little Mermaid, which is a remake. We just had Scream. We've got the Mission Impossibles. We've got Fast X out. I think Lewis and I want to have a discussion about which movies we actually would love to see a sequel from.
A remake, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be a provocative conversation that'll get everybody rankled.
You are loving the word provocative today.
I'm like Christina Aguilera. Somebody taught me that word, and I can't stop using it in interviews.
Well, let's put on your agent provocateur. And we'll be right back with more Keep It. On a very special episode of Stuck with Damon Young, Damon is joined by marijuana and hip-hop mogul Wiz Khalifa. That's how I describe myself.
Oh, sure. I concur. Together, they engage in a discussion that covers Wiz Khalifa's Pittsburgh accent, the influential role played by his son in keeping him informed about current trends, the dynamic nature of the evolving cannabis industry, and the significance of maintaining good health. Don't miss this episode. Listen to Stuck with Damon Young for free on Spotify.
Picture this, the year 1975, the song Love to Love You Baby by the iconic Donna Summer. The effect? Disco sweeps the planet, turning millions of Americans gay and leading to the creation of Keep It. Now, in the present day, we come full circle to discuss the Donna Summer documentary. But first, Lewis is going to make 23 orgasm sounds.
When you watch her standing at the microphone, it really feels like a physical undertaking. Jesus Christ. The undulating and the squawking. It also feels like desperate gong show contestant. You know, just, I'm going to get those judges up and gonging, bitch.
Yeah. I would have gone with the Apollo. She's hoping the hook doesn't come out.
Yeah, right. That too. I will say this. Donna Summer, staggering talent, personality in pop culture. I mean, there was once upon a time, people would have said she was the only major talent to emerge from the disco era. I'm not saying that's true at all, but that's this reputation she established, even when, you know, disco was soon derided by everybody, i.e. white men. But it's a lot to accomplish in a documentary, and I wish it lived up to her sterling reputation, because I feel like...
Girl's bad.
Yeah, what's crazy about this movie is the chronology of it. It can't just decide to tell a straightforward story of her. It'll do something like, we'll hear that Donna Summer invented the toot toot beep beep from Hot Stuff, mm-hmm. and then milliseconds later, both my parents were singers. Like, it's just like, it's like weaving this strange time irreverent tale of Donna Summer. And there are a couple of interesting things that emerge. For example, the size of her ambition and how she consciously decided, I'm going to give way more to this than to being a parent. Like, that is an interesting thing to watch in this documentary, especially because it's made by her daughter, who is very dutifully covering all of this archival footage she has of her mom. Mm. But the movie is not really interested in her music, really. Like, it in an obligatory way, like, tells you, I Feel Love was revolutionary. In this way, it tells you Love to Love You Baby was, you know, groundbreaking because it was this million minute long single. And you hear from the former president of Casablanca Records how he decided it would be a long song because people wanted to hear it repeated at parties. But other than hearing about how dim all the lights she wrote herself, like, you don't really learn much about the music. And the music is what's important about Donna Summer.
So the problem, too, is I feel like that the daughter was involved. You know? I mean, thank God for the archival footage. I thought what was really fun was, I don't think I'd ever really, from any, you know, like, adaptations of Donna's life or any other things I'd watch, learned, like, how much of a fucking goofball she was.
Yeah, truly. She has all this, like, camera footage of her family and, like, making them do skits and stuff.
Yeah. Do like, this one skit of, like, you know, her sister being, like, a psychic was, like, very fun. I mean, I relate it to... archival footage of interviews with her where she'd just randomly be talking in a British accent for no reason. but, man, it really felt like this should have been a play or, like, a different kind of movie that was basically from the daughter's perspective about what it was like to be Donna Summer's daughter.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
I really got, and, like, I get that, you know, like, you know, it's very important to learn that Donna Summer was, you know, abused by a priest in the church, you know, by a pastor. And that later her daughter was abused by, like, someone in the housekeeper's life, and how that affected Donna. But that turn, when it comes right before the point where you get to, you know, Donna Summer with her, going back to Jesus, being born again.
Yeah.
There's no line drawn for any of these points. So nothing feels like it happened because something else just happened. So it really felt like the daughter telling an important story to her and her mother, but it wasn't important to the overall understanding of who Donna Summer is and what led her down each path. You know, I think this story is very important to tell. But framing it as, like, a Donna Summer documentary was very odd to me. I kept thinking of How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, like the Bee Gees documentary, which was so fucking good and really, like, a gold standard now for, like, doing a documentary about legends, you know? We joked before on the show when we talked about it, you know, about the fact that, like, Justin Timberlake was in there as a talking head, right? Because he had done, you know, his Give impersonation on SNL or whatever. But even someone like that would have helped. There were no interviews with any of Donna's contemporaries. No interviews with people who worked with her. I was like, first of all, Barbara Streisand basically does anything these days, okay? And so I'm like, right. So I'm like, HBO, you couldn't get her on air talking about Enough is Enough? Like, what's going on here? Like, where were the people involved who worked with her who could talk about, you know, what it was like being in the studio with her, et cetera? That's what I was really missing, her place in the industry.
Giorgio Moroder,
yes,
who is, of course, the orchestrator of disco, who, you know, as much as, like, Burt Bacharach belongs with Dionne Warwick, Giorgio Moroder belongs with Donna Summer. It's that kind of relationship. He's reduced to, like, 90 seconds in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, you wouldn't even know from the movie that he wrote Love to Love You, Baby. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's confused about the impact of her music. And also, it does not place her music in context. You just said it. Like, you don't understand, like, what is going on in music at the time. Like, how meaningful it is for, like, Donna Summer to emerge, like, alongside things like punk, et cetera. Like, the landscape of the 70s is not spelled out for anybody.
They don't even discuss, like, Demolition Night, you know?
No,
where
right.
all those disco records are blown up, set on fire by, you know, a bunch of people who, like, in retrospect, we now know were, like, just, like, racist and homophobic, and that's why they hated disco. We don't get to that. Later in the episode, we're going to talk to Aisha Tyler just about... you know, one of our favorite books, Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs by Chuck Klosterman, right? And I feel like, well, the reason I love that book so much is it takes pop culture that's ephemeral and then finds a way to tie it together, you know? And it's if you're going to talk about an artist, you have to talk about what is going on in their lives. You have to talk about also what is going on in the world. One of the moments I knew that this documentary was not going to be good was when, like, her ex-husband, like, picks up the copy of Rolling Stone, right? And it's like, it's amazing that, like, this black woman got on the cover of Rolling Stone, and, like, they sort of, like, you know, say that in a couple sentences. I'm like, okay, tell me how you got this black woman on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Right, yes.
Where's an editor? Where's someone?
Yeah, right, exactly.
When they get to She Works Hard for the Money, the first music video by a black woman who was on there. And we know, like, tell us about the struggles that Whitney and Michael had getting on MTV. Tell us that they were racist at the time. Like, it's just like, oh, she was the first black woman to do that. I'm like, okay, why?
Right. And also, so they eventually get into the portion where she, you know, religion sort of changes her, basically. Mm. She becomes this born-again Christian. And there are it's like lightly foreshadowed in the way that she expresses with clarity that her performances on stage were always coming from a place of acting, that she, you know, is not the, you know, sort of writhing seductress in everyday life that she portrays, you know, as a stage performer. It's just that if you're going to perform those songs, you basically have to do that in order to sell them. That's the persona you hear on the record. But they get to the part where she is condemned for saying, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. She had a famous homophobic, I guess, extemporaneous moment at a concert. And then there were rumors. Then there are rumors that she had said afterwards that, like, AIDS is God's punishment for homosexuality, whatever, which I'm sure was, like, you know, an extremely popular sentiment at the time. It's a horrible thing to say, but I'm sure she wasn't the only one saying things like that. But they don't talk about, well, did she mean that? Because I come away from that being like, I think she did say it, and then never really owned it. You know,
yeah.
Like, it's just a strange moment. It's a movie that's trying to give you all these sides of her life and how difficult it is to be a parent, how difficult it is to be taken seriously as somebody who was making the music. Again, she's created some of this music herself. But then you have all these questions about how it all stitches together. Namely, how does she speak German? What did she do in Germany to, like, sudden, like, she joins the German production of Hair, and you watch her singing in German, and you're just like, what? How did you get here?
Unless you already know that, and I've read a book, you know, that told me about that, so, like, I wasn't confused, but I'm like, when she's like, if you don't know that history of her, it's sort of not in the documentary at all.
Yeah, it's random.
And
there's that famous quote from Chaka Khan when Donna Summer died. She's like, she's one of the few black women I could speak German with, which is legendary.
Yes. I'm sure Tina Turner was the other one.
Right. Who else?
Yeah. That international spy bitch. I also want to say that It's such a shame that Donna Summer was from that era, because she could say "fuck you, faggots" today.
Oh, please!
And we'd still be spinning the tracks.
She's marshaling pride. Please get out the megaphone and scream "faggot" at me from Santa Monica Boulevard.
Azealia Banks has said, "I want a truck to run you white gays over." And what do those white gays go and do? Listen to Anna Wintour.
Yeah.
So I also think contextualizing Donna would have helped, you know? What does anyone who was her contemporary then think about what she said?
And tons of those people are still around. Cheryl Lynn, what do you think? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, was it weird when you heard that Donna Summer said, you know, like, you know, maybe AIDS was a punishment from God, you know? Like, do you know someone who felt the same way? Did you know that it was a lie? Did you know that it was true, et cetera? You know, I just feel like there's no investigation going on in this documentary.
Right, right, right. And you barely heard from any gay people about that. Yeah, just, it could have used a lot more points of view.
Were there dancers? Were there people who worked with her? Yeah, I'm like, were they all under NDAs?
And by the way, they didn't even talk about the song that was out at that time when she said these things allegedly. This Time I Know It's For Real, which is in her top five for me. So it's just like, you didn't get the sense of even a fan's perspective in the movie. So if it's supposed to be this, like, you know, puff piece about Donna Summer, well, where's the puffing?
There was huffing. There was no puffing. And my house?
It's still standing. Oh my God. Your fractured fairy tales book where you coming soon. It'll be a pop-up.
What, before we wrap up, what are your favorite Donna Summer songs?
Let's see here. Well, I was pleased that in the final moments of the documentary, you got a minute of Sunset People, which has this like simmering street vibe that is really fitting Donna Summer's voice and sort of groove. That's one of my favorites. Dim All the Lights, I love. I do love the Oscar-winning Last Dance from the Oscar-nominated, and that is a shock in a Suicide Squad-type way, Thank God It's Friday movie. obviously, a song that'll live on far after all of us will. And I'm wondering if there's another one I'm forgetting. And this time I know it's For Real. That's my other favorite one.
I love Working the Midnight Shift.
Could
It Be Magic?
You love that big concept album of hers too, the Fairy Tale one.
Yes, I love that. Once Upon a Time.
Yes.
Amazing, amazing album. And also like just like her erotic era, you know, like, yeah, like Summer Fever, Try Me, I Know We Can Make It, which is 18 minutes long.
Good.
There's also Protection, which Bruce Springsteen wrote for Donna. And it's from the self-titled album. With Love Is in Control, Finger on the Trigger. Like, those are jams. That's sort of like her rock era. And it's like a really good album. So, like, if you haven't listened to that album, it's from 82. Like, I think that's one to get into. I wrote back in, like, 2017 for Vice, this whole, like, guide into getting into Donna Summer. So if you Google that, it's somewhere.
This podcast should just be you telling people, you know what, I handled this about 9 years ago. If you could just type it into the big old Google and spare me. Donna Summer, I think, is the only person besides ABBA where if you were to construct a playlist of just their songs, and these are artists that are functioning more than 40 years ago, I think you could do an entire party just on their songs. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's enough there that it's fascinating enough and kinetic enough.
I mean, just add in the remixes, too.
Please,
so,
yeah.
All right, when we're back, we're joined by the fantastic Aisha Tyler.
Our guest tonight has unmatched wit, charm, and if you don't recognize her, you must not own a television, because she is all over it all the time and has been for the past, 25 years or something? She is on Criminal Minds. You might have seen her on Whose Line Is It Anyway? Friends comes to mind. Talk Soup comes to mind. The Talk comes to mind. She's an author, director, and now you can catch her on the thrilling miniseries the last thing he told me on Apple TV. Please welcome to Keep It the incredible, venerable Aisha Tyler.
Wow, that was such an intro, and I will work very hard not to take umbrage with the word venerable. No, that was very lovely. Thank you.
First of all, psyched to see you just in general. You're hilarious, et cetera. But it's also rad to see you take a mostly dramatic role. And I'm wondering, like, how often does, like, a dramatic role, like, appear on your doorstep? Do people think of you as, like, a dramatic actress as much as they think of you as, you know, comedic, et cetera?
Well, I feel like my fan base is relatively siloed. And I think that that question kind of underlines that, because I am on a very grim, dark drama, Criminal Minds.
True.
I've been on there for six seasons. So that was probably, and I've been really super lucky. Like, the same year that I was doing Friends, I was also shooting 24. So I was doing, like, both roles at the same time. And so I've been lucky to kind of be able to straddle those two worlds. I mean, obviously, I come out of comedy and I got my start as a stand-up. And, I think that's how people think of me. But I've just been always really fortunate to be able to snag these dramatic roles. And I think some of the greatest dramatic actors of our time, you know, came out of comedy. You know, Tom Hanks started out as a stand-up, and his very first, you know, television show was like a super broad drag-based show that would not fly in today's climate whatsoever.
Correct, yeah. Even the phrase bosom buddies gives me shivers, yes.
Exactly. Eddie Murphy, Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, I think there's a really great tradition of comedians that make that transition. I don't even dare to mention my name in that company, other than to say that I feel like comedians were so accustomed to kind of deep bone slicing humiliation that we're very good at making this transition to drama because we understand suffering.
You know who I would compare you to, actually? Alan Cumming, you know, where it's like, actually, his entire career has had drama in it, but he cut such an imposing figure as, you know, this comic, confident talent, unmistakable persona that, like, you think of that first, and that leads to you thinking about comedy, and then you remember, oh yeah, The Good Wife, etc.
That is so flattering. He's amazing. Yeah, and I mean, I think, like, you know, if you look at some of the ways he's expressed himself in his personal life, you know, writing about his childhood, you know, comedians are really mining our tragedy for comedy, right? That's the métier, that's the art form. So, yeah, that's a really lovely comparison. Thank you. Very funny.
I will let Ira get a question in, but I just want to say, the fact that I brought up Alan Cumming's name and you already knew things about him, underline one of the things I just love about you as a celebrity. You actually know things, Aisha. I really appreciate it.
I will say this about that. I am a nerd. I always have been. And I read kind of compulsively. Like, I wake up in the middle of the night and try to, like, read the entire internet before I fell back to sleep. And when I was on The Talk, they used to call me Aishapedia. But it was not a compliment. It was accompanied by, like, epic eye rolling, because I was like, well, actually, guys, if you look it up, you'll find that. So I was that character from The Simpsons, constantly some version of mansplaining everybody, like, to death.
But even speaking about you knowing, like, literally everything, you know, from being on The Talk and then also Talk Soup, you know, you're so tapped into pop culture. And I have to ask a bit, because first of all, Lewis is always talking about how he spends his evenings rewatching Ebert and Roper.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
I recently rewatched one of your episodes.
I hope you did the one where there were good movies, not the one where there were bad movies.
Well, I want to ask just about doing that show, what it was like, you know, just being there with Roper. The episode that I watched was, well, unfortunately, you have to talk about the Black Dahlia.
Yeah, but okay. But by the way, that was the good episode, because I feel like that was Black Dahlia and maybe, like, Rocky Balboa. But then the next episode, I had to talk about, like, unaccompanied minors. I had friends in that movie. I was like, what do I do? It was amazing. I mean, I'm a movie nerd. I always have been. Like, when I was a little kid, I was very much a social pariah, like, you know, very much an outsider. And one of my favorite things to do was my mom would drop me off at the movies, like, at 11 when it opened, and I'd buy, like, a matinee ticket, and then I would just stay at the theater all day, and I would, like, sneak into every movie in the theater.
Same. That's how I saw the R-rated ones.
Oh, absolutely. You just wait 10 minutes until nobody was paying attention, and then you'd get on in there and watch, you know, Blue Lagoon or whatever, like, five times. Risky Business I see like 15 times in the theater. But you know, I don't think I knew then, like, you know, that it was going to define me as an adult. But I remember thinking, this is going to be so rad because I love movies and I just get to watch like a bunch of movies. And it is such hard work. I mean, you're watching five movies in a day. You're not peeing. You're not eating. You know, you can't just like tune out if you hate the movie. You've got to take notes. Listen, I wasn't like being down a coal mine or anything like that. You know what I mean? But it's easy to talk about a movie when you love it. And it's honestly, because I'm in the business, it's a little harder to talk about a film when you hate it, because inevitably you know somebody associated with it, or you just understand that it's almost as hard to make a shitty movie as it is to make a good one. Like, it's still the same number of hours. It's still the same kind of dedication. And then what comes out sometimes is just a big pile of, like, you know, steaming fecal matter. So I really had to work hard to be kind, you know, and I mean, I'll say this now, I don't care. So one of the movies was Apocalypto. And this was like midstream with like what we knew about, you know, Mel Gibson's inner life. And some of it had come out, but not all of it had come out. And I remember saying, listen, no matter what you feel about this guy, who he is, I have to say that this is a beautifully made film and very effective. And then some other stuff came out, including him saying that he wanted, you know, partner to be raped by a pack of expletives. And I remember wanting to walk back that review. And that's something I talk about a lot with my friends. Like, I'm very much not a separate the art from the artist person. And I understand that perspective, but I feel like experience informs art, and I don't need to give my money and support to people who have disparaged by people or other groups of people openly in public. That's just how I feel. And so it's interesting because I have very mixed feelings looking back at that experience. I loved it. And I loved working with Richard, and I love talking about film because I love film, but it's very, very interesting. Like, I remember later seeing him and being like, I want to kick him in the shin and like take back my review to his face, which I haven't had the opportunity to do yet. You know, there's still time. I just started an East Coast, West Coast Gibson Tyler beef. Let's see if the internet comes for me.
The movie Apocalypto should not cause this much consternation to anybody. I just want to say, I'm concerned.
It shouldn't.
Let alone
it shouldn't.
You.
It shouldn't. I mean, it's the thing is, you know, it's a really beautiful film.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's the larger question about, can terrible people make good art? And I can't answer that question in the paltry time we have allotted to us. But it is a question I ask myself constantly. You know what I mean? Like, can a bad person make good art? And do they deserve our support? And I don't know the answer to that. I write about it in my diary every night.
So this means you keep a diary.
Oh no, I don't keep a diary. I drink my feelings, friend. No way. I don't write them down. I wash them away with whiskey.
A sloshier version of a diary. I see.
Yes, no, okay. Exactly.
On the same tip, I want to ask about Talk Soup, which I just feel like I think a lot about, for instance, like the old perspective of things like VH1 and the Isle of the 80s crowd, which also I watched you on. It just feels like there was a certain fervor for discussing pop culture once upon a time that,
yes,
I guess now is sort of siloed, to use a word you just used, on things like YouTube and maybe Twitter. But once upon a time, there were really centralized locations where you would just hear people who were informed and funny,
yes,
talking about pop culture. And we really got to, like, this sounds very Pollyanna of me, but enjoy it together. Are you nostalgic for that era of sort of pop cultural commentary at all?
Well, listen, what took its place was the internet, wasn't it? It was
right.
Twitter. Twitter is where, you know, Twitter is our water cooler, you know, well, it was anyway. Now the water cooler area's just got, like, you know, just douchebags and tumbleweeds. But that was really where that's what took the place of, like, you know, those kind of like last week in and all the VH1 shows. And they try to revive them every once in a while, you know, these kind of 80s and 90s and aughts reviews. And they don't feel as urgent, right? Because they've been recorded and you can't interact with them. And I think that's the thing that I still love about the internet, is the opportunity to have an ongoing conversation that's constantly suffused with new information and new imagery and new ideas. And we didn't have that back then. So, no, I don't think that I miss it. You know, we're just so overwhelmed by input nowadays, right? There's just so much stuff going on. That I look back at those shows now and I kind of wonder why they were so compelling, even though I was on a lot of them. You know, even some of the shows that were popular a few years ago, Tosh.0 and the reboot of Talk Soup, you know, they feel a little dated. Mm-hmm. Because you're just hearing one person's perspective, one person's opinion. Or even if you have a little collection of comedians, you're hearing just kind of, it's very quippy. But you don't have the dynamic back and forth, that kind of asymmetric interaction that you get on the internet, which can be wonderful and terrible. But, you know, quite honestly, I kind of miss Twitter. You know what I mean? I'm not on it as much now. It's such a disappointing place. But I missed that fun and that dynamism of live tweeting something and having people shoot back at you and having it really feel like this, if not global, at least regional conversation.
Yeah. You know, I really feel like that era was, it's also when one of my favorite books came out, you know, it was Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs by Chuck Lostrom.
I love that book. Yeah. Oh my God.
I love that book. I love it. I love it. I love it.
And, that is the book that made me write my first book.
It's the one that inspired me to sell my first one. So
there you go. And I told Chuck Klosterman, I got to tell Chuck Klosterman that to his face. And he was like, that's weird, which is exactly the kind of response that you expect from Chuck Klosterman. But yeah, it's a great book. Absolutely.
I just remember, you know, high school into college, you know, these shows would be on the air, right? I love the 80s, et cetera. But you're right, they would mm-hmm. be quippy. And it was so sort of, I mean, novel to have this book come out and where it felt exactly like the thing that we were watching, but also someone was taking things seriously. You know what I feel
yeah.
like? I miss that on Twitter, but I also miss that in, you know, a lot of the websites that we read now, because I feel like we've gotten even past the, you know, sort of like, I would love to talk about this random movie from the 80s or something, but I would like something more than just, you know, a couple jokes about it and then we move on, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, like what Chuck did, and I remember telling him this, was that he synthesized, right? He drew these big, meaningful theses and conclusions from things that felt both ephemeral and minimal to us at the time, but we realized like later in life really affected us, the way we perceived the world, the way we perceived ourselves, things that really captivated us, you know, that we were kind of dismissing, you know, as again, as entertainment, as ephemeral pop culture kind of throwaway experiences. And he was like, listen, this said something about our era, or this made us feel something, or this changed the direction of our culture. And he was just so smart about pulling all these different threads into these like, and synthesizing them into these grand statements about American cultural history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a geek, as a nerd, you know, those things really did affect me. You know, like I collected comic books, but like that meant something to me. It wasn't just something like I was thinking I was going to sell later and like help pay for my like college car.
Right.
You know, like they, you know, and especially as a person of color and as a woman, like the way that I related to graphic novels and comic books, like there was a lot of specificity in those experiences that has affected me to this day. And they felt bigger and more important than the way that people would dismiss them as, you know, I mean, the word pop culture, you know, inherently implies disposability. And he was like, no, these experiences weren't disposable. They defined us, and it's okay to think about them that way. And these are my reflections. And I don't know, he was just such a smart guy. And I think, you know, we don't get that kind of elevated analysis of popular culture nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Something else that came to mind when you were talking about how when you hear like people talking about pop culture from 20 years ago, you're kind of just getting one perspective and it's not as interactive. And that makes me think about stand-up, which you obviously came from. Do you find yourself craving stand-up as a viewer less because it's that? It's just one person talking and giving commentary, and like the internet has made interactivity so much more kind of craveable in terms of perspectives and stuff. Do you worry about the vitality of stand-up in the current entertainment climate, I guess?
That's a good question. I mean, I will say this. I feel like comedy used to be a lot more disposable, like when Comedy Central was such a powerhouse of stand-up and there were like all those little like bits and bites and like, you know, Saturday Night Stand-Up and, you know, I mean, even the Comedy Jam, like which was, you know, really obviously like a defining show, a seminal show, but there was a lot more of these little digestible like bits and bytes of comics all like amalgamated into one show. I do think that like a great hour still has relevance. And, you know, these big thinkers that put together an hour that really says something about themselves, their experiences, you know, who we are as a culture right now, those things still mean something. And I always wanted, and I don't know that I necessarily accomplished it, but it was what I wanted for myself, was to put an hour together that felt like a body of work, felt like an album, you know, felt like Led Zeppelin 4. You know what I mean? Like you had to listen to it beginning to end, and it said something of a piece rather than just an accumulation of singles. And I don't really think that that's what my special did, but that was my my hope. And I feel like great specials really do that, you know, early Chris Rock, you know, Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip, for all of its like inherent and specific and absolutely real problems, you know, Eddie Murphy, Delirious, you know, they were a piece of work, right? They were a piece of art. And I still think that that kind of comedy has impact and has meaning, you know, Bo Burnham special Inside, or oh God, her name is not in my head because I have the memory of a drunken toddler. I'll think of it in a minute. There have just been a lot of great specials that have come out and really felt meaningful. And, you know, even some of the early Dave Chappelle specials, I think, you know, really landed and really meant something. And I still think there's room for that kind of art now. But you know, not every comedian, not like every musician. I mean, you know, comedy is like music, like it's consumable. And again, all art can be disposable depending on how people consume it. And then every once in a while, something comes out and really radicalizes people. You know, whenever I would give advice to younger comedians, typically when I was drunk and against their will, I would always say that, that, you know, being funny is important, but it's really not the most important thing. The most important thing is to tell the truth. And when people come and see a show and it's funny, they go, oh, that guy's so funny. That was so enjoyable. But when someone says something really honest and real, that's when people go, holy shit, you have to fucking go see this guy. You know, and that, and I brought up Live on the Sunset Strip because, you know, that's what, you know, Richard Pryor's talking about setting himself on fire and that he almost died. You know, or some of his early stuff where he's talking about the fact that he grew up in a whorehouse and he was forced to, you know, perform sex acts on adults as a child. Like, that's shit that shouldn't be funny. You know what I mean? But he's owning his experience and he's transforming it into something that he's weaponizing it on his own behalf. And that's the kind of comedy that really changes the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world. And it's the kind of comedy that helps the comedian transform the way they see themselves and the way they see the world. And that's the kind of stuff that I think is extraordinary, and there's still very much a place for that kind of comedy, you know, in the world.
When you said Led Zeppelin 4, that really trips something in my mind. I really do think a good comedy special is like an album, that sense of like being introduced to an entire personality and like, you know, like a few random vignettes in their life, episodes in their life, and how they add up to something, and you kind of are left with figuring out what it all means.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm looking forward to John Early's special so much, his music one, you know? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And like, you know, even Marc Maron, like one of the things I really admired about Marc Maron was that his sets really felt like he was riffing, like they were like a jazz set, or, I mean, God help me, because I'm not a Fish fan, but like, you know, going to watch Fish or Grateful Dead or something. Like, it felt like he was making it up as he went along, but he very artfully was not. You know what I mean? He very much had a plan, but it felt to you like you were being carried away on this wave of like ideas. And you would just be transformed, you would really submit to it, you know? And, you know, and then at the end, you know, we masterfully kind of bring it all around. And I really love that kind of comedy. He was somebody I really wanted to emulate as a baby comic, because it always felt like he was just making it up as he goes along, man. He's so cool. He's like the weird old Miles Davis of San Francisco. I wanted to do that.
I'm picturing him married to Cicely Tyson now. Okay, yes.
A girl can dream.
I mean, also just speaking of like a big comedy that you've been involved in for years, so fucking long. Archer, which I'm such a huge fan of. I wonder just what it feels like doing a show since 2009. The last season is airing this year. What your relationship is like with, you know, a television show that you've been doing this long, that you're being funny on, just what does that feel like coming up on the end of it?
You know, it's bittersweet. I mean, mostly bitter because we still feel like we have lots of stories to tell. But very few shows get a 14 season run. I mean, it's so unusual in and of itself that maybe, you know, we've gotten comfortable with the idea that we were never going to go off the air just because, you know, it's such a beautiful, extraordinary piece of creative. I'm not saying this because I'm on it. I mean, it's just such a great show. It's so unique. There's nothing like it. And I remember when we did the pilot, I was like, this show is never going to go. It's just too smart and too funny and too dirty. There's just no way it gets picked up. And so every season has felt in a lot of ways like a revelation, that we keep getting to tell these incredibly, you know, sophisticated and at the same time base stories. I mean, there's just so much elegance and so much erudition and literary sophistication in the show. And then there's just dick jokes on dick jokes. It's my favorite kind of comedy. A word that Adam Reed and I coined like really early in the run was the word smilthy. That was smart and filthy. And it's a show that, you know, is so layered that you discover things over and over again. Every time you watch the episodes, there's so much buried comedy in it. I'm just so proud of it. And I'm so impressed by the cast. They're so good at what they do. And I feel very strongly that there's never going to be another show like this one. There have been ones that have emulated it and ones that people have mentioned in the same, you know, voice, you know, and they're great shows, you know, Family Guy or Bob's Burgers or BoJack Horseman. But there's just nothing like Archer, you know, and I'm extraordinarily proud of it. And it's just been a joy. It's been a joy to make. So I feel like I'm just savoring this last season and the time with the cast. You know, we rarely see each other. We don't record together. So we see each other a couple times a year, like typically at Comic-Con. And it's just this massive kind of like golden retriever pile of like hugging and inappropriate comments. So I'm really looking forward to that. You know, I'm looking forward to having that experience with them this year and just super proud of it. Super proud of it.
Really just consistently funny. And I really just enjoyed it. And it's also since it's been on so long, there are moments where it's like, I haven't seen like a couple seasons and then I just love binging them like together to get ready for the new season. So, I mean, congrats on the entire run of that.
Thank you. I feel... you know, it's obviously Adam Reed, who created the show, is just a genius. And Matt Thompson and Casey Willis have taken it over are, you know, equivalently, you know, high level thinkers. And then this cast is just, they're all extraordinary comedians, like effortless comedians. And, you know, getting to do something like this for such a long time, it really starts, I'm not without being glib because, you know, everyone's working really hard, but these characters really get in your bones and then the opportunity to kind of push and find new ways to be funny and new opportunities to kind of straddle the line between comedy and kind of like, you know, deep emotional exploitation. You know, there have been some real emotional moments. You know, Archer has sacrificed himself multiple times to save Lana's life in absolute like ingenuousness. You know what I mean? Like there are these real emotional moments on a show that is, you know, literally... we've done jokes where, you know, there's been a threesome and there's boob shapes on the wall in fecal matter.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Years ago when I worked at a blog, we would occasionally ask people who are as nerdy as you are and rightfully claim to be, what their favorite movie scene of all time is. And I feel like you're somebody who has seen everything. If I ask you what your favorite movie scene is ever, what would it be?
Oh, shit. I really want to give you like something super sophisticated. And I'm bummed because I feel like I'm going to disappoint you and the world. Man, okay. This is not my favorite scene, but it is a one of my favorite beats. It's not even that great, but it is a great movie. Okay, so I'm a big action fan. I always have been. I was raised by single dad, so like you know that was something we did together. We would like he'd take me to movies that were like you know way out of like the appropriate like you know viewing range for my age. And one of my favorite movies when I was a kid was Die Hard, and it still holds up. Mm. The first film still holds up absolutely in every way, and there is this there's this beat in the film where there's like a tank or a Humvee or something coming up to the building up to Nakatomi Plaza, and it's gonna like blow out, you know, it's gonna like come up and like attack the building and everything like that. And there are the terrorists are arguing about what to do next. And Alan Rickman is talking to the German guys and he's like, "Schieß in die Fenster." And they don't know what he's saying. And he's very delicate, right? Alan Rickman says he's so brilliant in this movie. And he's, "Schieß in die Fenster." And the guy's like, "No." And he goes, "Shoot the glass." And then they shoot all the glass, which kicks off a cavalcade of exciting moments for Bruce Willis, who has to then walk barefoot across this room full of glass, which ticks off a question for you as like an 11-year-old watching this movie, because that's why you love, you know, action movies. You're like, you're always imagining that you're going to be the one that would save the world. Like, what would you do in this situation? You know, and you always think that you'd be the one to like, you know, crawl across the glass and swing across an empty elevator shaft. And I don't know, those transporting kind of ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances, you know, things are always the stuff that I really loved about old-fashioned action movies. Nowadays, everybody's like taking like 17 bullet holes to the chest and then like going and having, you know, like an iced latte. But back then, you know, guys got hurt. They got cut. You know, they died. So that's, it's like, again, it's not the greatest scene, but it's a great, great scene. And I want something more filmic. I want something that people can be like, "Oh, she's a student of film." But as I think about it, all of my favorite scenes are from action films. Bourne Identity, Terminator, Out of Sight. I love great analog action movies. You know, I know we're living in a digital age of CGI, but I really love an old fashioned action film. Linda Hamilton doing pull-ups at the beginning of Terminator 2.
Oh yeah.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Yes.
Every time I shop for like athletic wear at ASOS, I'm trying to be Linda Hamilton. I want that gray tank. I want those pants, those boots. Yeah, yeah.
The kind of the cargo belt. You know what I mean? Yes. And I need to just find a rusted cot to tip over in my backyard so I can do some pull-ups. Yeah, those were the movies that really formed me. And I think they're beautifully written films and you know, beautifully evocative performances, but I was just such a weird little kid. And I wanted to save the world. And so I was always just drawn to those moments where ordinary people push themselves past their limitations to do extraordinary things. And I think that's still what draws me to film, is seeing people make great personal sacrifice, for others.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Aisha. As expected, when we heard you were going to be on the show, we're like, "Oh, thank God, somebody who's so rad." Just like you could talk about anything, and we love that about you.
Oh, that's so nice. I wish that I could put my little face in the camera, but it's such a pleasure to meet you guys, and so lovely. Thank you for such smart, thoughtful questions. And God, what a delight. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. With the premiere of The Little Mermaid, the fifth Indiana Jones, and, of course, my favorite, Fast X, is there any IP left that hasn't gotten another chapter or interpretation? And which ones do we think are due revisiting? Now, Lewis.
Yes.
You know what my number one choice is.
Are you going to throw down Salt?
Salt. You know we need a Salt, too. And actually, we've got to the point now where I'm like, Salt remake? I don't know. There's a film coming out that has Angelina Jolie and Halle Berry in it.
Oh,
it was
right.
Announced.
Yes.
That's supposed to be like some sort of spy action thriller. That sounds fun. But I'm just like, see, even seeing the commercials for Indiana Jones 5, seeing Harrison Ford's ass running around here, I'm like, what's good? Angelina Jolie is still like in her best shape.
Right. If there's a Salt sequel, it better be called Salt with a Deadly Pepper. And there better be Salt and Pepper on the soundtrack. Salt and Pepper have two amazing album titles, that, and also, of course, Hot, Cool, and Vicious. Nobody's all three.
You know what's going to be a weird choice for me to say? I recently rewatched this film. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
Interesting. What do you think we would do with that movie? Well, which, so, by the way, is, of course, very cute, and Kate Hudson is very winning in it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, and Bebe Neuwirth is iconic in it.
Can we just have a Hall of Fame of, like, third-billed people in rom-coms? I'm talking about Nora Dunn as your publisher or whatever is going on in these movies. I love exactly those people. Bebe Neuwirth can, of course, do anything.
Yeah, I just think I was rewatching it and finding how funny I hadn't seen it since it came out. And I think it's so fun that, like, she's working out this story, you know, that's about scamming him, and he's doing this ad and like making this bet for her. I feel like it says sort of a lot about men and women at the time and sort of about the media landscape at the time. And then they get together at the end. And I just sort of wonder what that movie looks like now.
Yeah, right.
I wonder what it would have to say about the media world, what it would have to say about men and women. You know, I think that it would be interesting, if not, you know, a sequel, because I also think they're so fucking, they're so great on camera together. Kate Hudson is, like, so charismatic. Matthew's at his best. It was before the ego got out of control.
Yeah,
with
right.
Him giving 20-minute monologues at the Oscars and then announcing he was going to run for office.
Right.
Before that. So I would love to see that. Or if not, some loose remake. I hesitate to say remake because a remake would be like some Netflix version of like He's All That.
Mm-hmm,
you know, the
one
with Addison Rae that was abysmal.
Oh, yeah. She didn't win an Oscar for that, did she? No.
But she had some steep competition that year. Okay.
You're right. I should be more sympathetic. I'm sure she turned up at the Indie Spirits.
But I am in love with, and this is maybe a different topic, but I'm in love with a remake that isn't quite a remake. And I wonder, like, the Writers Guild rules for this, because it's just like, so Blue Jasmine, right? That is A Streetcar Named Desire.
Correct.
But you watch it, and at no point does it say, like, based on. And I feel like a lot of writers get away from saying, like, inspired by something.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
Where's my inspired by? How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, where you're kind of remaking it, but not really remaking it. You know, like Splash, and you get to, you know, that fucking A Fish movie.
Right. Shape of Water, yes.
Okay.
You know, okay, I am somewhat enchanted by the fact that a movie like Top Gun can spawn Top Gun Maverick. I don't love Top Gun Maverick, but like, I like that amount of time passing before we get a sequel and just like the world of change that happens in between.
Mm-hmm.
My vote for something from that time that we should do a sequel to, and I say sequel because apparently there's some remake version with Selena Gomez coming out, or was announced anyway, Working Girl. Because you get, first of all of those people are still with us. I'm talking Melanie Griffith, I'm talking Sigourney Weaver, Joan Cusack, Harrison Ford. Alec Baldwin might not be available, whatever. But everybody's there.
What's going on with him?
Yeah, he's finishing the movie Rust. Everybody's excited to see it. When we get updates about that fucking movie, I'm like, are we in hell? Are we in hell? Just in the way that we're allegedly getting a 9 to 5 sequel, this is specifically a world that has been turned upside down since that movie came out. The idea of being a professional person, the strange competitiveness and yet camaraderie that can occur at an office. I think people are a lot more skeptical of not just the quote unquote the workplace, but like the fulfillment you're supposed to get from a job, and like who gives you money, and like what your and who your overlords are, and what you should think of them, and how grateful you should be for a job. So I would love to see a lot of those people come back and see, like, you know, maybe a Melanie Griffith character, Tess McGill is her name in the movie, who's maybe still working, coming up against a young upstart employee or something that they're colleagues with, or maybe she's the boss. Anyway, I think I just miss Mike Nichols terribly and would love anything in the realm of Mike Nichols to live anew.
Can I say a wild one?
Please do.
And, you know, it's such a shame because, you know, like, much like Mike Nichols, the director of this film is no longer with us. But Big.
Interesting, which I believe, do you know what's interesting about Big, first of all? Do you know who wrote Big? Steven Spielberg's sister. Yes. There is a sister Spielberg who was nominated for an Academy Award for original screenplay. And also, by the way, Elizabeth Perkins is still turning it out every which way and out. So if we can get her back in this, I would love it.
I fucking love Elizabeth Perkins.
I'm sure she'll be in the Weeds reboot or whatever that we just heard.
This Weeds reboot, comma?
And a Nurse Jackie reboot?
You know what? I'm seated for one of them. You can guess which one.
If Betty Gilpin comes back to Nurse Jackie, then I'm seated.
Okay, then I will watch that. Okay, I'll be seated for both. you got me, Showtime. I think, you know, we had that movie Little, which was basically a reverse Big,
right,
you know, uh-huh, that Issa Rae was in and Marseille Martin. But Big, you know, with all of the, you know, the thing about like an adolescent boy wanting to be an adult, right? I think now maybe we're in the era where, you know, like you'd want to be younger. But what that would even mean? And would he want to be younger present time or like younger back in the 80s, you know? And I think that you could get a, you know, it's sort of like that movie 17 again, too. But I think that, like, if you get, you know, the cast and you reversed it with Tom Hanks, it would be fun, you know? I also just, I don't know, maybe he's, like, too old for this now to want to be, like, we'll see him, like, running around in, like, denim jeans and dancing on keyboards and stuff. But I just miss when Tom Hanks was fun, too. Tom Hanks has not made a movie that I want to see.
I know. No, when he made A Man Called Otto, it's like, you don't want me to see this, I guess. I mean, like parents in the Midwest have to see something dignified every once in a while, and that movie was for them. But you're right. Like,
dignified?
I don't remember. It was apparently well-reviewed. Apparently well-reviewed. No, but also just, I've been enjoying interviews with Tom Hanks recently. I saw him, I think, talking with TCM about Casablanca or something. I mean, just, he's so sharp. So, like, I would love to see him do something that, whimsical again. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, that's not a new Toy Story. You know?
I will say about, like, Big, though, Diablo Cody, my friend, former Keep It guest, had one of my favorite tweets of all time, and I know I've said it on this show. She goes, "You couldn't make the movie Big today because every 30-year-old acts like that." And I'm like, yes!
Speaking of Diablo, honestly, I think a Juno sequel would be good.
I mean, I don't even know how we would tackle it now, given, you know, Elliot Page's new identity. And that said, Michael Cera was on Celebrity Jeopardy recently. He's sharp as fuck. I'm sure he can still turn out the Michael Cera gulps, you know, which we love from him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the Elliot Page of it all. But, you know, I think that, I don't know, that story was so interesting to me. But, you know, like, I feel like politically what happened after and how Diablo feels about it. It
right,
would be interesting to see that story now with them as, like, older parents, you know? And honestly incorporate, you know,
Of course.
Elliot's life into
that would be great.
The character. And that'd be so interesting to see, like, you know, maybe their relationship just strayed. Maybe they're not together. I just think that kind of story might be really interesting, especially now, you know, with so much of the, like, you know, trans debates in this country and around the world are sort of, like, going on the same with all of these abortion debates, which was a heavy thing that had to do with the original film, Juno, you know?
Mm-hmm. And also, that would give another opportunity to Allison Janney, who belongs in my newfound Hall of Fame for third-billed rom-com people, because in 6 Days, Seven Nights, she's the one who's on the phone with whomever, Anne Heche, being like, "You have to get the story," or whatever, then puts down the phone. I love that we hired people for that shit. It's so funny.
Anything else that you'd want to see? What's a film that you think should be remade?
A movie. Well, I mean, when I hear that a movie should be remade, I'm thinking about a 3-star movie where we appreciated quite a bit about it, but something is not quite right. Like, you know what? I mean, honestly, I don't love the series, but Fatal Attraction is the right kind of movie where there's a lot going on for it that's unforgettable. There's a tension to the movie that you're watching every second. It's like Black Swan or something. Like, you have to just keep watching. But the ending is problematic, as Glenn Close has talked about again and again, and that's the reason you would make remake it as a miniseries, as they've done with Lizzie Kaplan, who was on last week. So I'm going to say something like that. I'm going to say Field of Dreams. Why? I would love to hear the version of this story where it turns out the Kevin Costner character is just crazy. He's not following his whimsy. He's just out of control and obsessed with building a baseball field for reasons that are sad. That I would like to see.
Okay. Okay. Here's mine.
Okay.
It's a film from an iconic director. Okay. One of our best.
Can I get a year? Can I get a year?
It is 1964.
Marnie?
Yes.
I am the best. God. I think... Come on now.
Well, that's why I love
Who
you.
Who throws it down like Lewis? Tippy's still here.
That is why I love Lewis Vertel, everyone. No, and listen, they don't even need to be involved in it. I just think that it's one of Hitchcock's lesser films.
Right. Yes, right.
You know,
right.
The writing's all over the place. The misogyny is all over the place. The ending sort of really doesn't make any fucking sense. It's almost camp, but not camp enough. And I think that with the right director, you know, like... I don't know, if someone crazy like Almodovar or like Todd Haynes like really wanted to remake this film. But, you know, someone who has those sensibilities, I think a Marnie remake by someone like by either a homo or a woman needs to make remake Marnie. You know, because like Alfred Hitchcock with his shit with women was just like, there's no way that movie was ever going to turn out good.
Right. Yeah, Alfred Hitchcock, the strange thing about him is It's just in a way crazy he isn't gay, because like just his obsessions with like the certain roles of like glamorizing women in a certain way that was both sexualized but like aloof. It really was more like the women are fabulous more than they're sexy in those movies. You know what I mean?
I think it was more about having, you know, like collecting women.
Yes, correct, correct. No, that's interesting. I just watched Rope last week for TCM. And
Rope would be an amazing. I would love a remake of Rope too. I'm not precious about like remakes of older films, provided that, you know, the person remaking them and the people cast in them aren't, you know, awful.
Correct.
You know?
Also, the thing about Rope is there is one real problem with that movie, and if you haven't seen it, it's one of Hitchcock's shortest movies. It's about 82 minutes, based on the Leopold and Loeb murders. These two guys who are snobs kill this guy for the sport of it, and then they throw a dinner party with him buried in the table in the middle of the party just to see if they can do it. And the problem with the movie is the main killer, John Dahl, he is fabulous. He's an Oscar-nominated actor from a movie called The Corn is Green with Betty Davis. The other guy, Farley Granger, who is gorgeous, not a good actor. So no. I think if we remade it and that character, who is supposed to be really hold the tension of the movie, and he's freaking out the entire time about getting caught, and why did they do this, and... he also seems to be the most sexually thrilled by the strangulation at the beginning of the movie. So there's a lot of fascinating facets to that character that could have been explored better by a better actor. So I would say that.
I think a beautiful blend of like that movie with the sensibilities of like Scream. Because Billy and Stu are basically
correct.
Leopold
yeah.
and Loeb, you know, exploring their like sexual tension with one another too. I know we ended up with Gone Girl, but, you know, like, remember when Gillian Flynn was supposed to reteam with Fincher and Ben Affleck to do Strangers on a Train?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we never got that. Oh, my God.
We never got it.
Another Farley Granger joint. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how, but I'm going to find some way to blame HBO for this not happening.
Okay.
And because, you know, we're already mad at them for, you know, the whole, like, turning into Max this week.
Starting
or whatever.
Today, yes.
Today. But do you remember that David Fincher had like two shows at HBO?
One
of them
did.
Was like video, Sing Crazy, like his version of like Veep, and Entourage. And then he also had a series, Utopia, And these were, you know, I guess they were budget disagreements or whatever, but these were shows that there were writers' rooms for. They were written, they were created, and then they never happened.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
I thought David Fincher was one of those can't-miss people.
Well, I mean, you know, Netflix shut down fucking Nancy Meyers. I don't know that she needed $900 million or how much she was asking for one of her things. But The Kitchen alone, you know.
Nancy, no, based on how much money Nancy wanted for that rom-com, I mean, were they inserting a kitchen island on the International Space Station? It makes no fucking sense.
I want to know what's really going on with that budget. Okay, like, do we have some gambling problems, Nancy? Okay, are you being blackmailed? If you need help, just let some people know. Okay?
Right.
People would gladly help you, but I'm like, this is giving pyramid scheme.
No, right. I mean, first of all, how does Williams-Sonoma not just fund her entire life? I just don't understand how that happens.
All right, when we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis, what's going on?
Mine is really dumb. This is one of the dumber Keep Its. Mark Malkin, venerable reporter who now works for Variety. You probably know him as the bespectacled E! Red Carpet host.
Yes, he's always asking somebody a gay question on the carpet, and I love him for it.
Yes, right. And he's very direct about it. Yes, often goes viral quite a bit. I guess he was at some sort of function where Zooey Deschanel was promoting her new show, What Am I Eating?, which I guess demystifies food for people. If you have questions about how food is made or how long it keeps or whatever, it's one of these shows that gets into what's actually healthy for you. So somebody asked Zooey Deschanel, who, by the way, has never been a Gangbusters interviewee. And they say, what's your favorite food in LA? And he posted this clip. I don't know. He took this video himself. I don't know why he posted the clip, but her response is so guffaw worthy. She says, is it tacos? Is it ramen? That's the thing about LA. There's so much food all over the city. I just can't believe it. I can't believe how lame a response that is.
Is it tacos? Is it ramen? By the way, I get the tacos. Is LA a ramen city?
I also, not foremost, not like, oh, you must go and get the wet noodles in LA. Jesus. I would put Korean barbecue well ahead of that. I cannot stop this video.
Is he trying to take her down?
Is it ramen?
Because now it's
bewildered
giving
and mystified by multiple foods in a city. Oh my God, it's so funny.
Because now it's giving the show she's hosting on Max, which is called What Am I Eating? Which dropped today, actually. It's giving, well, let's just find someone affable to host this.
I guess.
Because she doesn't seem like she gives a fuck about food.
Also, my thing about her is she kind of a Gwyneth where she got sick of acting? She just would prefer not to do it anymore? Because I feel like she's still, this is somebody who looks identical to when we discovered her, whatever, a million years ago in Elf. You would think she would just be acting all the time, but you get it very sparingly from her. Because she had that Hello Giggles site for a while, so it's like she became interested in these other enterprises. Plus, she's dating a property brother, and they both, to me, look like they're trying to be Don Trump Jr., just physically. And I don't think they want to be that, but when you wear those flannels and you have that scruff, you're asking for it.
Yeah, I think that if she wanted to act more, she would act more. I mean, I don't think you do Trolls and Trolls World Tour to get that coin.
Right.
Unless you are really, like she did Harold and the Purple Crayon, which comes out next year. I don't think her heart's in it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, right. Emily Deschanel, call in and explain it to us. I know you've got that Bones money and you're sitting on it and you have time.
Bones, that was really one of our great shows.
And what was it? I'll never know. Sometimes I just say the words Dr. Temperance Brennan because Slay, just those words.
Are they rich too? Because
yes.
Like,
I think they are.
Where's Emily?
No, that's what I'm saying.
She ain't working either. Well, Devil in Ohio, she did this weird-ass, awful Netflix show last year. But, yeah. Wow. It's weird that they were just so omnipresent in, like, the 2010s.
Yeah.
And now they're completely just, like, who thinks about the Deschanels?
Right. No, they're like the state school Farmigas. You know what I mean? Vera and Thaisa, they're up at Juilliard or whatever. These girls are relatable. You want to see
where
them
in sweats. Maras? Where yeah. are the Maras at? Are Maras, they're the weirdos, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, they're off at Oberlin, for sure. Yeah. Also, we had Kate here last year. Still a slay in that a teacher show. She did a great job.
Yeah.
Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it this week goes to the notion that anyone ever thought that we needed Christine on Selling Sunset.
Hmm.
Now, Selling Sunset, obviously, is a show about blonde women who hate each other and date their boss and sometimes sell houses.
Correct.
In Los Angeles. Now they are selling them everywhere. Like, there's scenes on the beach this season. You know, they're selling L.A., basically. You know, but the Oppenheim Group office is on Sunset. I was worried about Christine not being on the show a little bit until last season when Christine basically she Heidi and Spencered herself, you know, like when you burn too bright and then everyone hates you on the show and no one wants to film with you, like then you're not a useful cast member anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone keeps saying, you know, she left Selling Sunset to, you know, become like a socialite, like a fashion model. She's getting on these spreads. I'm like, I haven't seen one in a minute. So we'll see about that. But she's rich, so who cares? This season, however, is so good. The girls are carrying. The girls, to borrow a phrase that I know annoys you online, Lewis, the girls are clocked in.
Oh, you know what? I can get into some clocking in. I myself have seen clips of Chrishell on the show, and all right, I'm getting it. Like, this person is, like, owning screen time and reading people the filth, throwing the book at people, if you will.
I, of course, am friends with Chrishell, IRL, and she's been on the podcast. But I would say that she used to be a person who was more of a shrinking away from conflict on the show. This season, she's come out swinging. And so when you say clocked in, she is clocked in.
She's clocking people. Yeah.
Yeah, she's clocking people.
Yeah. Haymakers coming from Chrishell.
Call up Spike Lee because these ladies are clockers.
Call up Toni Collette because we are clock watchers.
The show is really fun this season. And I think that now that Christine is not, you know, this big, you know, cloud hanging over everybody, people are having a bit more fun. People are mixing it up a bit more. Some people are very annoying. There's this new girl, Nicole, who allegedly has been a part of the Oppenheim group for 8 years.
Exciting.
I've never seen her before. It's giving Nikki and Paolo from Lost.
A season six edition. A cousin Oliver.
She has longstanding beef with, like, Chrishell, and she dated Jason, one of the bald Tweedledee Tweedledums who run the Oppenheim group. But I have never seen this woman before. Like, who are you?
Wow.
It is very weird to integrate someone into a reality show like that. When normally that would happen, like cousin Oliver joining the Brady Bunch or something, you know.
Right.
And then there is this woman Bree, who is completely ridiculous, and I need to let you know, is spending a lot of time talking about her open relationship with her man. And one of the women on the show, Chelsea, hates this open relationship. And at first I thought she was going a little bit too hard for monogamy until I found out that Bree's open relationship and the man that she had her baby with is Nick Cannon.
Excuse me.
One of Nick Cannon's baby mamas is one of the new women on Selling Sunset this year. And I'm like, oh, well, girl, you're crazy.
Well, also, statistically, one of the baby mamas will appear on Selling Sunset. Just, I mean, like, if you're doing a census of L.A., like, a few of them will show up.
But, 1 in 8 women in L.A. has a child with Nick Cannon.
Oh, my God. Wait, so is his name not mentioned on the show?
It's mentioned. It just took a minute, and I maybe, like,
that's
drowned it out before I heard it. And I'm like, that's a gag. And then another woman, another one of his baby mamas is announced as having a baby in the news, like, during the course of the show. So,
help me, God.
Anyway, this season is great, and we did not need Christine at all.
All right. You know what? I think for the Chrishell content alone, I will actually have to watch this, you know? Non-competitive reality TV rarely sits well with me, but this I can make time for.
I mean, listen, you just gotta hold in long enough for her to ask someone if they're a crackhead on the show.
Remember when you would just call somebody a crackhead? I guess you can't really do that anymore. It's kind of a thrilling phrase.
I love it. But me personally, I make way too much money to ever do crack. Crack is cheap. See, crack is whack.
Oh, Whitney. Why did she get to be funny in addition to all these other things? Like, Donna Summer, never really funny. Whitney, hilarious.
Do you know, Diane? Do you really know?
The tilting head. Well, I guess that would be me.
I think we are due for a Frost Nixon, but about that Whitney Diane interview.
I would absolutely love it. I think that will actually happen. I do not think that is a pie in the sky idea. Because Diane Sawyer's moment, I think, is her come to Jesus moment is still to come. She hasn't exactly, she's had a couple of dubious interviews over the years that I think are worth reexamining, worth her reexamining. Yeah. Not to besmirch the world of Diane Sawyer, because of course she was married to Mike Nichols.
Mm, yes. It all comes back to Mike.
Right.
Eventually, we're just going to have to do an all Mike Nichols episode.
Keep I do it. Not hate that at all. I'll even watch Catch 22 for it.
All right. Thank you again to Aisha Tyler for joining us this week. And we are dark next week for Memorial Day. So I hope you enjoy your holidays. I hope you watch the Ben Affleck movie, Memorial Day. That's what he made, right?
Is that real? Okay.
No, it's not real.
All right. We'll see you in June when we'll be busting out all over like Leslie Uggams.
We'll be full of pride.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Not another one of those. Fuck.
Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram and Twitter, and subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, that's me, and Louis Vertel. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Malconian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week. And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.